not done this one before, actually. But even if we have, it'll be different each time because it's not me doing it, it's us contributing and bringing it alive together. So, what I wanted to do today is a sutta from the Anguttara of Fours, and it's number 28. So, AN428, and it's called Noble Lineages. And in the Buddha's day, there were societal lineages, which, of course, the Brahmins thought were their noble lineage. They thought they were very noble. But the Buddha's noble lineage is quite different. The Buddha's noble lineage means the Buddhas, the Arahats, and the Sangha who have realized the truth. So, true noble lineage means people who've walked and realized the path. So, this is one of the most popular suttas taught in Sri Lanka, apparently, according to the footnotes. And often sermons are given on this sutta in depth. So I thought that this might be interesting for us also because it talks a little bit about becoming content with our requisites, which might be helpful for the new Anagarikas who already do have a kind of robe. So even though usually we don't talk about robes until we take the actual 10 precepts and above, so Samaneri and Bhikkhuni precepts or other forms of ordination that which allow you to have an actual brown robe, still they are already wearing robes and have undertaken the Anagarika training with a view to going forth. So it does feel like a bit of an extra step. And I have to say, Chu's wearing her robe extremely beautifully, both of them. But of course, Anu's been wearing it a long time already. But it's amazing to see the folds and the creases settling around Chi, making her look like she's so cozy and protected. It's so beautiful. And I can see she does have this quality already. And then, so there are four qualities that the Buddha talks about in this sutta as being, basically, how do you say that? I'll just read it, I think. But they basically mean that we're standing in the ancient primal noble lineage. So it's by developing these qualities that we are in the noble lineage. Okay, so in other words, the lineage of the Arahats, those who have awakened to the Dhamma, to the Four Noble Truths, and to the highest happiness of complete freedom from suffering, which means freedom from existence, freedom from samsara, freedom from the cycle of birth, aging, sickness, and death. And even when we're celebrating a child's birth, the perfect child with all the faculties intact, the real celebration is that she may have an opportunity to come a bit closer to the highest happiness of full liberation as a human being. So, let's begin this sutta. And as usual, you're very, very welcome to and encouraged to participate. For those who arrived a bit later, I did write a message in the chat for the early birds to say that we will limit questions and comments to a maximum of three, which is quite generous. There's a lot of us here, so we're not all going to get three anyway, but that includes comments in the chat box, and that will just help to ensure equal participation. So I'm thanking you for your understanding and harmonious cooperation in advance. So I will start reading. You may raise your hand at any time, and I'll come to you in due course. I'll try and go between the chat and the room, and also the room here. In as fair a way as possible, but sometimes I might miss someone. Just keep your hand up or put your comment in again, and I will do my best to get through all of them. Okay, so here we go, and it's on page 414 for anyone who has the book. If one of our co-hosts could type it in the chat, that'd be great. And go to a four, number 28, Noble Lineages. So, again, the Buddha's speaking to the monastic community, but anyone else who was present at the time would have heard this sutta. And of course, we can apply it to ourselves. These are principles, these aren't exclusive teachings. The Dhamma is for all. So here we go. Monastics, I'll say for now. There are these four noble lineages, primal, of long standing, traditional, ancient, unadulterated and never before adulterated, which are not being adulterated and which will not be adulterated, which are not repudiated by wise ascetics and Brahmins. So even the Brahmins, when they're wise, they understand that this is the true noble lineage. That's quite powerful already, isn't it? That this can never be repudiated. In other words, this is an ancient law and these things will always hold true, no matter what culture or time we're born into, that these things stand the test of time. And in that sense, truly are a part of nature, a part of what comprises this whole universe of cause and effect. It's kind of powerful stuff, transcendent stuff. So it also means that if anybody does try to repudiate this, they're not very wise. It's not repudiated by the wise. So the word repudiate is a bit of a strange word, but it just means disputed in a sense, or like they don't try to argue with this fact. So number one, here, a person, in this case a monastic, is content, or even an anagarika, with any kind of robe, and they speak in praise of contentment with any kind of robe, and do not engage in a wrong search, in what is improper, for the sake of a robe. If one does not get a robe, they are not agitated. And if one gets one, they use it without being tied to it, infatuated with it, and blindly absorbed in it, seeing the danger in it and understanding the escape from it. And yet they do not extol themselves or disparage others because of this. Any person who's skillful in this, diligent, clearly comprehending and ever mindful, is said to be standing in an ancient, primal, noble lineage. It's quite a lot in there. I love this part straight away where it talks about the contentment. So you have that contentment, but then you speak in praise of that contentment also. In a sense, this is how our attitude kind of ensues in speech. And then due to our own contentment, because we speak in praise of contentment, we actually influence others in the same direction as us. We're spreading good vibes, you could say. And then one does not engage in a wrong search in what is improper for the sake of a robe. Not agitated, and one gets it. If one gets one, they use it without being tied to it, infatuated with it, or blindly absorbed in it, seeing the danger in it and understanding the escape from it. It might seem strange that you could be blindly absorbed and infatuated with a robe, but the nature of the human mind is that when you give up one thing, you tend to get attached to something else, because it's not actually the external objects that are the cause of our attachment. It's the tendency to cling, to attach, to stick to and possess things, which is the issue. And basically they're going to find something to stick to, even something as seemingly ordinary and unattractive. Actually, these are made to be unattractive. The color's supposed to be the kind of color you'd never buy in the marketplace. It's supposed to be the dye from a tree, which is a kind of slightly mockier, slightly greener version of what I'm wearing now. And yet we can still become kind of proud or infatuated, or kind of think, well, their robe fabric's much more fine than mine. You know, mine's really coarse, or maybe mine's synthetic. You know, maybe it's not warm enough and I want a warmer robe. But even if we have the proper attitude, we don't become proud of that because of that and extol ourselves or disparage others. So Ajahn Brahm has a joke. He sometimes says, I'm so humble, you know, something like, I'm so humble, it's just, I just have to tell everybody about it. It's amazing how humble I am. So, you know, even if we have good qualities, if we actually get proud because of that and start bragging because of that, or take it personally, right? Not seeing that these things are conditioned by our good fortune, maybe to come across supportive conditions, wise teachers, conditions that many other people have created for us, then we turn our good qualities into something that's not so skillful anymore. We become spoilt in a sense. Any person who's skillful in this, diligent, clearly comprehending, and ever mindful, is said to be standing in an ancient, primal, noble lineage. So I will try and speak through the rest of it without interrupting the flow, but there's already a comment in the chat, so I'm going to come to that now so that we are not confused as we go forward. So the question is, what is meant by seeing the danger in it? Maybe I didn't hear properly. Yeah, you did see, you did hear properly, seeing the danger in it and understanding the escape from it. This is something that is commonly spoken of in the suttas. The Buddha talks about it in relation to sensual pleasures, that there is a gratification, but there's also a danger. So he doesn't deny that there's something there that is gratifying, that we can enjoy, that is pleasing to the mind. And the danger in it, as Diana said, is that we can become attached, that it can lead to suffering, lead to clinging, which is not just the cause of suffering, but clinging in itself is a type of suffering. Because when you're clinging, there's a contraction, right? When you're clinging, there's a sense of potential loss, you know? I mean, if you just cling with your hand, if you just hold your hand now into a fist and try and cling on to something, like say there's something heavy and you've got to hold it, it starts to hurt, doesn't it? It starts to hurt your hand. In fact, it'll hurt my shoulder if I do that because I do have a dodgy shoulder, which I'm not meant to roll back. So clinging hurts. It hurts us. And of course, the more that clinging leads to craving and the kind of pursuit of the things we are, we feel we're in need of, the more trouble we get into as a result. So yeah, there's a danger, and the escape from it is in a sense, using it for the purpose it's intended for, and escaping from those negative responses to the things that we use. Okay, so yeah, I am using Bhikkhu Bodhi's book. Yes. Okay, so Joseph, and you've numbered your question. Thank you very much. It's interesting to note that the requisite of medicine isn't mentioned. Yes. Yes, that's right. But let's see what is. Okay. So number two, again, a monastic is content with any kind of alms food and speaks in praise of contentment with any kind of alms food, and does not engage in wrong search in what is improper for the sake of alms food. If one does not get alms food, one is not agitated. And if one gets some, they use it without being tied to it, infatuated with it, and blindly absorbed in it, seeing the danger in it and understanding the escape from it. Yet they do not extol themselves or disparage others because of this. So if they see someone next to them who is infatuated with their food and absorbed and going, yummy, yummy, they don't look down on that person. That's the challenge, isn't it? Don't you think? If somebody else is scoffing their food down, especially a renunciate, you know, look at them. I don't do that. I've never done that in my entire life. And they're senior to me. Right? So maybe that's quite a practice. They do not extol themselves or disparage others because of this. Any person who is skillful in this, diligent, clearly comprehending, and ever mindful, is said to be standing in an ancient, primal, noble lineage. Mm-hmm. Number three, again, a person is content with any kind of lodging and speaks in praise of contentment with any kind of lodging and does not engage in a wrong search in what is improper for the sake of lodging. If one does not get lodging, they are not agitated, and if one gets it, they use it without being tied to it, infatuated with it, and blindly absorbed in it, seeing the danger in it and understanding the escape from it. Yet they do not extol themselves or disparage others because of this. Any person who's skillful in this, diligent, clearly comprehending, and ever mindful, is said to be standing in an ancient, primal, noble lineage. And here I guess I could just quickly bring in Joseph's comment about that the requisite of medicine isn't mentioned, because the first three are three of the four requisites for monastics, the fourth being the medicine. And I think in this context, it could be because there is probably a little bit less danger and less likelihood even of getting infatuated with medicine, most probably, because medicine tends to be something that is quite functional, you know, used for a purpose, used for sickness, and most people don't particularly enjoy taking medicine anyway. But interestingly, it could extend certainly in the way we practice in the modern day in monasteries in the West to things like chocolate and cheese, which I think would come more under the subject of alms food. You know, it's supposed to be a medicinal requisite that we can eat in the afternoon, and it's one of the most common questions I ever get asked here at tea time. Why do you eat chocolate and cheese? Is this from the suttas? Is there any kind of, precedent for this? Or is this, you know, something completely random? And I think the point is that it's supposed to roughly kind of tie in with the idea of using something like ghee or honey, or even something that might have been like carob, something like that, that you could loosely kind of imagine could be made into chocolate. But honestly, I think people quite fancy chocolate and cheese as something to eat in the evening because it's tasty and it's full of fat and sugar. So somewhere along the way, there's obviously been a Sangha decision around that before my time. And it obviously had the agreement of that particular Sangha and has been in operation ever since. But if you think of regular medicine, I doubt that it's particularly conducive to infatuation or blind absorption, etc. There's probably less of a concern with misusing it in terms of sensuality. Yeah. So Shirley's saying, if you're very sick, maybe it can be skillful to ask for more suitable medicine as self-care and kindness to oneself. Absolutely, yeah. And if people are sick here, I usually do ask them, especially if it's a gastric issue, if they want something small to eat, like some oats. I mean, I have been taking oats in the evening for a very long time. My teacher in Burma had to convince me that I needed to do it because I was so sick, and I thought, I better not do that. I'm a non. How can I do that? You know, it's one of the basic precepts, right? Not to take food after 12 noon. And in the beginning, that's kind of very important to you as a trainee, because it's the one thing that's different from being a layperson. It's the main thing that's different, other than entertainments and shows, which I wasn't doing anyway. But actually, the whole purpose of that is for your own good health and to not be a burden to others, to not be a burden to the lay community who need to feed you. So if you think of it in those ways, it's much more burdensome for the lay community to have to pay your private hospital fees because you're so ill, because you refuse to eat something, or because you eat cheese and chocolate instead, which actually makes you sicker. or that you need to eat a full meal, you know, and then actually have the kitchen team preparing food again. So it makes a lot of sense to me to have something simple like some oats that can be just soaked in hot water or just put in the microwave and be done with it. You know, it makes a lot more sense. And I have personally found that it's been more a case of having to develop contentment with that than getting infatuated with that. If you eat a bowl of plain oats every day for sort of 15 years or more, it gets pretty boring. And I have to say, in the last 3 years, I've started allowing myself to put miso in there and even a bit of cumin seeds, which are allowed as a medicine, digestive medicine. Both of those two things are allowable on their own. So, and it makes it easier to digest. So We really have to find our way with these things, be very honest to our intentions and purposes and how we use the requisites. And of course, have a basic motivation of compassion that is then applied with wisdom. I think this is the heart of the Buddha's teachings. I mean, when Ajahn Brahm pays respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, he pays respects to virtue, compassion, and peace. Virtue, peace, and compassion. He uses the word compassion interchangeably with wisdom because wisdom should ensue in compassion. And if it isn't, it's not real wisdom. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. So they are the first three, and we can go into them in more detail shortly. But the fourth one is interesting, and maybe this is another reason that it's replacing the idea of medicine, because this one can pretty much sum up the entire path. And remember, this is for monastics mainly. So the first three are important because it's how you actually live. It's your way of being as a monastic. If you're not able to use the requisites with respect for the true purpose, for supporting your practice, etc., then you're not going to engender trust and faith in the lay community. And people's generosity will not be fully honored. Mm-hmm. We have a responsibility to the people who offer us things to use them in a way that brings them merit, that brings them gladness, happiness, and benefit. And we can only really bring the person who offers things the highest benefit if we actually practice well, right? People like to give to monastics who practice well. Sometimes I feel that you're all championing me when I'm on my longer retreats, because for a while it took me some time to think that I could be on retreat without letting the community down in terms of teaching. But then overwhelmingly everyone in my trust and the volunteer circle, and I think Zoom groups too, said, no, you're serving us by being on retreat because you're deepening your practice. And, you know, even if you're away for an extra few months, like last year I was away for 5 months, away, sort of actually deep inside and very much with you all. But, you know, 2 extra months made a massive difference to me. And in the long run, it doesn't make a lot of difference to all of you if you don't have me giving you teachings for 2 months. Other people are giving a lot of teachings. The Dhamma is there. Your practice is there. And so overwhelmingly, people said, this is how you make good use of our support. So it's all very beautiful. It's a very beautiful system. So the last one. Again, a person or a monastic finds delight in development. And that means mental development, citta bhavana. Is delighted with development, finds delight in abandoning, and is delighted with abandoning. Bhavanarama is delight in development, and Pahanarama is delight in abandoning. Yet one does not extol oneself or disparage others because of this. Any person, any monastic or layperson who is skillful in this, diligent, clearly comprehending and ever mindful, is said to be standing in an ancient, primal, noble lineage. These monastics are the four noble lineages, primal, of long-standing, traditional and ancient, unadulterated and never before adulterated, which are not being adulterated and will not be adulterated, which are not repudiated by wise ascetics and Brahmins. Monastics, when a person possesses these four noble lineages, if one dwells in the East, they vanquish discontent. Discontent does not vanquish them. If they dwell in the West, they vanquish discontent. Discontent does not vanquish them. If they dwell in the North, they vanquish discontent. Discontent does not vanquish them. If they dwell in the South, they vanquish discontent. Discontent does not vanquish them. For what reason? Because one is a steadfast one who vanquishes discontent and delight. So you can go anywhere You can go anywhere, into any situation, any circumstance, any community, and discontent will be vanquished. Contentment will never leave you if you fulfill these four lineages. So then we have a little poem. Discontent does not vanquish the steadfast one, for the steadfast one is not vanquished by discontent. The steadfast one vanquishes discontent, for the steadfast one is a vanquisher of discontent. Who can obstruct the dispeller who has discarded all kamma? Who is fit to blame one who is like a coin of refined gold? Even the devas praise such a one. By Brahma too they're praised. That's very nice. We're not a victim anymore. We're not vanquished. We are the vanquisher. So, contentment as a superpower. There's a lot of themes in this. So I'd really like to open up to some discussion at this point. These sort of discussions go very, very fast, but it'd be lovely to hear about how this might apply to your lives, because here we're talking about monastics, and that's great. And maybe you have a relationship with this as a supporter of monastics or as an aspiring monastic. But how does this relate to your life? I'm coming to Manohi. You don't have to answer that question. Anything goes.
It's a question from me. So my question is, Venerable, does these contentments come naturally with the practice? Mm-hmm. So we don't have to artificially worry about doing something, or are there any kind of easy tools that you recommend for a lay person to slowly develop?
Okay, super question. Yeah, thanks. I think it's both, you know. I think often when we ask those questions, we're already having some insight into the fact that it can go both ways round. It's almost like the practice, what we do on the cushion, kind of primes our mind. It generates qualities that are very skillful and beautiful and wholesome. And of course, contentment develops, because if we're watching something like the breath or practicing loving kindness, we'll see in our own mind when we're becoming a bit restless or agitated, and we'll see how that creates suffering and moves us away from contentment. And it's almost like there's this kind of inner sort of guide when wisdom is operating in the mind that steers us away from attitudes that perpetuate discontent and actually enables us to develop more contentment, because the more we do that, we get the kind of instant result in our practice. However, I think just simply relying on practice for that can be misleading, because it's when we come in contact with the ordinary things of daily life that we need to be able to apply those things. You know, contentment when we're feeling peaceful, when the breath and the meditation are going well, is quite easy. But what about when there's something a little bit more challenging or maybe stimulating that brings up our old cravings? And it might be different for each of us. There might be some people who are really attached to the way they look. There could be many reasons for that. It might not be just superficial. It might be that your mother or father has always told you that it's important to present well, because if you do that, you can get a good job, you can be respected in society. Maybe they praise you a lot for your appearance and that makes you feel loved. You know, there can be many reasons. And also, of course, we're incredibly profoundly and unfortunately superficially conditioned by adverts and all the rest to look a certain way so we fit in. Sometimes you can't even buy stuff that you want because it's not in fashion. And it's coming at us all the time, how we should look, how we should dress. I'm sure as a finance professional, there's a certain way you should look in the office. Like, you know, you can't have your hair too short, for example. You also wouldn't be able to have it just flailing around. So, yeah, and then we might find that in that particular field, we're more likely to judge others. So I'm really interested in this part, not only about how we get sort of blindly absorbed in these things, because blindly absorbed might mean we're not aware of how we're conditioned. But it's the part about not excelling oneself or disparaging others, because I think this subtle judgment and comparison is going on all the time for us in life. Finding out who's part of our club, you know, who's worthy of our company in a sense, who's doing the right thing and who's not. And we do judge on appearance. So that's one. And then I think to be able to notice these things coming up in that context is really important. The same with food. Food's a massive trigger for a lot of people. Our relationship with food can be quite a tricky one for many people. Sometimes we might be really hungry. And then there might be a danger of us, as monastics especially, engaging in a wrong search. That could mean for a monastic that you go on alms round at the wrong time, or that you kind of press people a bit, or you get too specific or too upset about what you're getting or what you're not getting. So I think, you know, in that case, developing contentment is also developing a sense of gratitude for what we do have. And then we use it without being tired or infatuated, etc. So, I mean, as monastics, we chant a little reflection before the meal that says, I use this food not for beauty, not for pleasure, not for fattening, only for the maintenance and nourishment of this body, for keeping it healthy, for helping with the holy life, thinking, thus, I will abandon, I will allay hunger without overeating. And in some suttas, it says something like, I will abandon old unpleasant feelings and not generate new unpleasant feelings. In other words, I'll allay my hunger, but I won't overeat so that I feel stuffed, right? And in this way, we live blamelessly and at ease. So it's a reflection. And I think lay people can do this too at the start of a meal. You know, how often do you choose food? It's about how much you eat and the attitude you eat with, but also, how do you choose your food? Do you choose it based on the flavors, or do you choose it based on what's good for you? Do you make some sacrifices according to health conditions, for example? How are you driven around food? And then the other one, the lodgings. Are we always in search of a bigger house? Do we go in a wrong search? Do we kind of keep bidding on the property, even though someone else already was received an acceptance? There's all kinds of ways, right, that this could come in. If we do not get the lodging, we are not agitated. That's one, isn't it? We had a concrete example of this. We tried to sell our property in Oxford, and then it wasn't sold, and we had to try not to become agitated because of that. It's a bit the other way around, but I think the people who pulled out were probably quite upset as well. So it's a very stressful thing in the world, isn't it? The buying and selling of property. Yeah. I mean, I would also consider that contentment with any kind of lodging, all of it is pointing to a life of simplicity. This idea of just hoarding properties, having more and more and more property when there are people who are homeless who have nowhere to live, there's something unethical about that to me. So there are many ways we can consider this. Yeah, I hope that gives a few ideas. Yeah, I think it's both. And then we practice again on the cushion. But with these things in mind, we might be able to see more clearly where that discontent is coming from. Yeah, I think when we have more happiness through meditation, certainly we rely less on particular material things. Yeah, that's what I noticed. In Burma, I didn't care where I slept. I just slept on the floor. There were snakes. There was everything there. But it was fine by me. I was happy to share with the snakes to a point. They never came too close. Okay. So I'll just come to one in the chat. I'm not sure if it was already there. And then I'll come to Shirley and Corinne. So Shelley says, it's hard to imagine contentment without shelter in an environment where you can freeze to death from being outside. Absolutely. And if that's the case, imagine when that person does get shelter, how contented they would be. So that's a reflection we can use. And I don't think anyone has the right to ask a person to be content without. This is to be content with the kind of lodgings we have, right? We're not asking people to be content without them. Everyone needs shelter. But we can perhaps use that as an example to become more content with what we have. We might think, oh, I don't want to sleep in this freezing cold room. I'm sleeping in quite a cold room this winter, to be honest, really cold. But it wasn't freezing. I mean, sometimes it was probably zero. But I had a big duvet, I had a roof. There was a lot I had. And so no matter what we have, if we can compare it with how things could be, we can develop a lot more contentment. And that might give us more compassion to help people who don't have shelter, to donate to charities or to feed the homeless, you know, things like this. I remember reading about a woman in America who basically, she developed an organization just from herself, by herself. In the beginning, it was like a grassroots thing, where she would just collect money from the community, I think her own money initially, and pay for a number of homeless people to spend a night in a hotel. And then it just grew and grew and grew to the point where people could have night after night in hotels until they managed to get some housing. So there are things we can do, but no one person can do all of it. We have to understand that we need to work together. It's a tricky one with donating, because sometimes people prefer to give material things, because apparently that brings more pleasure to the mind to actually give a gift that you can see has gone somewhere. And we tend to get more gifts of food, etc., than we will monetary donation. But actually, monetary donation, you might not see the effect of it, because you know your donation alone won't work, but it's bringing it together with many other people's donation has a massive effect. Yeah. Anyway, Shirley, I'll come to you. Did you get your yes?
Yes, I couldn't find where to click. Sorry. I loved this sort of, I thought it was really, really relevant to lay people. The first three, I just think, are so relevant to our society in a rather gross way, not sort of practicing the refinement of renunciation, but I think our society really encourages discontent, and so many people are suffering because they want the most modern clothes and the new house and a new car and the best possible food, you know, particularly with housing and clothing. And a while ago, I sort of resolved not to buy any new clothes, and I sort of try and live off charity shops, really because of the damage to the climate of the fashion industry, and a lot of clothes just being, you know, used once and then thrown in the bin, not even taken to the charity shop, and ending up in landfill. And then that's when the judgment comes in. But I remember having a conversation with some teenagers about, I can't remember what they call it, but some kids now, instead of sort of just wanting to keep up with fashion, they buy clothes from charity shops and make them into something trendy. And there's actually a word for it. And the sort of pleasure.
Glam knocker.
Have you got the word for it?
No. I'm joking. Glam rocker. What is it?
But
upcycling, is that right?
Upcycling. It might be. No, I don't think it might be. It might have been upcycling.
Upcycling.
But that is a word. But and you can do it with furniture as well. But the pleasure I had from that conversation, because we were both praising this, and that sort of get, and then I thought that's what felt much nicer than being judgmental.
But
there is so much suffering caused by you know, the insistence of our society to have more and more and better and better. And of course, there are more and more people now who have less and less and are struggling, and we can't ask them to be content.
Yeah, that's right. No, we
but just to sort of reflect, I was reflecting when Minori asked her question, I thought, what is it makes me value contentment so much? And it's good friends, and maybe not no longer being in the workplace. And I was, you know, I worked for local authority, so I wasn't in a sort of job where I necessarily, you know, had to dress up smartly or anything particularly. But I think you know, because all my friends sort of, they're not acquisitive. And because I wasn't brought up to be acquisitive in that sort of way, I think it's a lot of it's just about our conditioning.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Who we mix with and what we watch.
Yeah.
And where we put our attention.
Correct.
But and I'd just like to share my very favorite Buddhist quote from the Buddha, which is contentment is the greatest wealth. I think that's true, because people who want more and more, they might be millionaires, but they're still quite poor.
Absolutely. In fact, the poorest people, aren't they, who are wanting. The more you want, the more the poorer you feel. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I want to pick up on a couple of points you made. The first one, I mean, loads of it, really, but I'll just go to a couple. One of them was that you mentioned not only being finding the pleasure in contentment, but noticing that when you speak in praise of that contentment, it brings more happiness. And I think that relates to what you said about it's all conditioning. And maybe this is how we can recondition. This is also a kind of conditioning, right? So we're developing the contentment, but then we're also, rather than disparaging others and extolling ourselves, instead of that, we speak in praise of contentment. And that relates to what the Buddha talks about here, where he says, finding delight in development, that is developing, that is cultivation, that's mental cultivation, right? So we're finding delight in actually not only being content, but talking about being content, directing our mind more and more to that experience. So we get more and more happy the more we discuss it. I mean, these kind of conversations are so wonderful. There's another sutta where the Buddha says, that part of our speech is speaking in praise of contentment, speaking in praise of being contented with little, speaking in praise of all kinds of beautiful things, fewness of wishes, which are all related. Yeah. And I've noticed that when I start speaking about things like that, it's just so joyful because we are actually actively reconditioning ourselves. So again, it's not a passive thing where, oh, we are just conditioned, like helplessly. We can be part of the conditioning of ourselves in wholesome ways. So yeah, great comment. So I'll come to Karin. And then I'll come to the chat.
Thank you, Venerable.
Hi.
I hope I can make sense of this. I'm reminded of contentment in relating to others. So I can think of a few people in my life, perhaps an older generation, who believe their contentment is directly related to making somebody else content. So that's conditional. But it almost becomes controlling because that's their view of what is the other person's contentment.
Yeah, and it's not real contentment if
It's
it's
not real contentment.
no.
But they would argue it gives them a sense of satisfaction and that this is an act of generosity. So I'm just thinking that sometimes these things can be so, perhaps it goes back to the danger element, can be so, have to be so careful with these things and really go into yourself and check your motivations, which comes back to the conditioning, So if giving dana, for example, becomes like it could also become a form, it could also become something unwholesome.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
No.
Yes, I mean the Buddha speaks
So
about
it's about the
giving.
boundaries.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a sutta where the Buddha speaks about the different types of giving, and there are all kinds of different sort of purity of intention behind the giving. So some, I mean, it's good to give anyway. It's generally seen as better karma than not giving. But if it's motivated by a wish to kind of manipulate, I mean, that could be seen as actually not very wholesome at all, right? And then sometimes you give because you think you should. You give in the sort of, it says, because of tradition, because the elders say you should do it, because you think that giving is a good thing to do. It's not terrible, but the highest giving is when you understand the real purpose for giving and you do it to beautify your mind. So, in other words, it really does have a pure intention behind it, and it's coming from a place of genuine kindness and generosity. So, yeah. But I think in here, I mean, when it's saying about the danger, it's not talking about the danger in misunderstanding contentment. It's just talking about the danger in getting infatuated with these things, blindly observed. Yes. So, yeah, maybe that's what these people are doing, actually. And they may feel that that's contentment, but it's not actually what is meant by contentment here.
No, because I think it will cause ultimately discontentment because it doesn't give that.
So it's coming from discontent.
Yes. Yes.
It's not only that it will cause it, it already signifies discontent, because if we have to do something in order to get somebody to respond to us in a certain way, we are already discontent. You know, there's already some sort of lack that we're trying to fill through manipulating the way other people respond to us. But again, not to judge that in others, because we can't really know their intention, and none of us are going to be 100% pure of intention all of the time, or even most of the time. But it's something we learn along the way. And yeah, I guess looking inside at our own motivations and trying to purify those as best we can. And the best way, I guess, to see how pure our motivation is whether it's bringing a sense of genuine peace. Like, how do you feel if you offer something to someone hoping that they'll be happy and they're not happy? Do you still feel good? Or is your happiness thwarted by that? Or can you still feel happy that you did your best? Sometimes if we do things from beautiful intention, it doesn't matter what the result is. It's the same in our meditation. If we're meditating because we want to get peaceful and we don't get peaceful, yeah. Do we think, oh, that was hopeless, I wasted my time? Or do we think, no, I was happy that I tried. I was happy that I gave this time to the practice. I had good intentions and I can feel good about that. Never mind about the result. So it's putting more wisdom into planting the causes.
So that reminds me to go back to the Eightfold Path. Right intention.
Yeah.
What is that?
Right intention. I mean,
into that and that as a way of sense checking.
Yes.
Where am I coming from here?
Where am I coming from? And in a way, you could say that contentment is very similar to renunciation, to Nekama Sankapa. I'll leave that with you. I won't explain it. Yeah. Excellent. All right. I am coming. I think that follows on to the next question. And there's a couple of questions here. Then I'm going to come to someone in the room. In fact, there's about two or three. And then I'll come to Casey, who's right here. So, okay, the next question. It feels important to confess to my spiritual friends that I find the word abandonment triggering. Yeah. First of all, then I'll change it into the Pali. It's pahana. Is that okay? Pahana. That's a nice word. Okay. A depressive thought to cultivate peace and care around is a depressive thought to cultivate peace and care around is feeling scared to take refuge in those who delight in abandonment when one has experienced the pain of abandonment. Oh, yes. It doesn't mean that kind of abandonment, but I'll continue reading. What is meant by abandonment in this sense, and how does one avoid cruelty, neglect, and apathetic indifference when cultivating delight and abandonment? So it's just a different thing, in short. Abandonment, pahana, remember the Pali, because English is always an approximation, okay? But the word pahana rama means delight in letting go. I think that is much closer, delight in giving up, in giving things away, in letting go. And when the Buddha talks about letting go or abandoning, he always means abandoning cruelty, abandoning neglect, abandoning apathetic indifference and anything that creates suffering for anyone. So it's abandoning the unwholesome states. It's abandoning those things that cause harm. So finding delight in development and delight in abandoning are two sides of the same coin. It's like you delight in developing contentment and abandoning discontent. You delight in developing loving kindness. You delight in abandoning hate. The two things are the same. It's just which angle you look at it from. So that's what it's talking about here. It means delighting in abandoning infatuation in this context, abandoning becoming agitated, abandoning engaging in a wrong search. So all the things here that are spoken of as not being wholesome. And I think really this is talking about the sixth factor of the path, so part of right effort, the four right efforts, right? Two of them are to develop and to maintain. So development in that context is bhavana, and bahulikata, like to fulfill. It's kind of like overflowing, like you fulfill certain positive qualities. And then the other two are like abandoning and keeping, like abandoning the unwholesome and keeping out the unwholesome. So yeah, I mean, the English word is definitely can be triggering, but remember here, it's also a verb. It's not abandonment. It's abandoning. It's the act of letting go. So I think that's what it's pointing at here. Yeah. I find that in meditation, becoming aware of silence is a good tool towards contentment and also afterwards. Great. Especially if you can be content with that silence. Yeah. And in a way, I guess maybe one of the reasons that silence goes together with contentment is that silence, there's very little there, right? There's very little there. Contentment is contentment with little. So the more we can get used to having less and less in our mind and be okay with that, the more contentment is genuine. If you can be content with like almost nothing being there, imagine how much more content you are with, say, a kind word or, you know. But then we might also have to practice being content with noise, etc. as well. But yeah, it's a lovely way to start being content. Okay, one more from the box and then I'll come to Casey. And welcome to Sirivinya. I think we did start, I think you're now late actually because the UK time has changed. Maybe that's why. Yeah, but never mind, you're here. You can catch up with us on YouTube afterwards. Nice to see you. All right, so I'm currently in the process of taking a big step into the unknown, which involves giving up my job, rented flat, and other stuff without really knowing what comes next. This sort of feels very soothing, counteracting the fear which can come up when meeting uncertainty. Excellent. A good reminder to view the letting go as practice rather than experiencing it as threatening. Yeah, great. And of course, when we're practicing, we get afraid at certain times, you know, there will be a fear and it's okay, and you don't have to force yourself to let go of things you're not ready to let go of. But yes, certainly see it as a simplification. The less you can be happy with, you know, the less you need to be happy, the more confident you are that you can face anything that happens in life. That's why I think at the end of this sutta, the Buddha's saying that with these four factors developed, one can go anywhere. And discontent does not vanquish one. One vanquishes discontent. In other words, no matter where they go, they won't be discontent no matter what kind of lodgings or what kind of robes or food they receive. And this is one of the qualities that's so important as a monastic, because you don't know where you're going to be sent. You don't know where you're going to end up. You don't know what you're going to be asked to do. You just don't know. And there's a certain confidence that comes with having developed contentment that you will be able to face whatever it is, whatever comes. So it's not to say that we don't try to get a nice job and a nice new flat or whatever it is, but it's about not engaging in the wrong search. You know, have a wholesome search for that. I mean, a wrong search is also another topic, isn't it? You don't engage in a wrong search or in what is improper for the sake of that lodging or that food, etc. So you keep your seal really strong.
Mm-hmm.
You don't kind of thwart anyone else in their search. Okay, so now I'm coming to Casey. We only have 5 more minutes. It's amazing how fast these things go. So yes, now you're fine. Okay. Your voice is loud enough to carry.
Great.
If anyone can't hear, raise your hand and we'll adjust.
So I was actually going to give my 3 allotted comments all at once, but one of them was about fear, so I will pass over that one. I do think fear is a very interesting form of attachment to examine, and I know it definitely has led me, you know, astray in the past, that sometimes we don't think of it because it's not so clearly ill will or so clearly greed. But yeah, so that's a very interesting one, but I will pass over that one.
But just to say, I think it's on the side of ill will, fear.
Yes, I think so. There's
side of aversion.
Yes.
Yeah.
One is just that one of my favorite stock phrases in the suttas is the not extolling yourself or disparaging others on that account. One reason is I feel like it always comes at the point when you're extolling yourself or disparaging others as you're reading along the list, like, oh, I don't do that. Oh, I don't do that either. Oh, that's great. And then you reach the end, it's like, oh, right. Don't, not to get too caught up in it. Or you think, oh, well, I've met people who do that and do that, and you start disparaging and then you get there. So it's just kind of the perfect timing. It's always the perfect reminder. Or if you're disparaging yourself as you read along, oh, this is not something, you know, yeah. I don't need to disparage myself over this. So I just wanted to say that I really like that aspect. And then to move on with it, on the my third thought is just about how closely contentment is connected with our expectation. And I think that there's so much room to explore with that. So I won't go too much into it. But just one example of that is, I think something I've talked about recently with some friends is how our expectation changes over time at what place in our life we are. And then it becomes much harder to go back to something that we once had, but we once were content with, but are no longer. So for one example, when we're young, maybe in university, we're very content with the dorm room as a lodging. But then as we get older, then we want a flat. And then if we lived in a house, then we want a house. And so then even though we were once very content with something less, the more that we get, the more we expect to have, the harder it becomes to develop that contentment. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I definitely see in my practice. And I think it's very relevant to lay people as well.
Yeah, that's really good. You know, it's... Anyway, I have to make this comment now because it's coming to my head, but they do say that most people, or at least, yeah, it's quite common that people who used to vote one way change and vote another way in their 40s in a way that means that they can maybe keep a bit more of what they've earned, pay a bit less tax, etc. So they become kind of attached to what they have and reluctant then to share, whereas in their earlier life, they were more free and easy, let's say, and kind of liberal-minded. So people tend to get more conservative over time, and that's due to fear. It's been proven psychologically that people who are more fear-based tend to vote a certain way, more conservative type of way, because that's about kind of holding on to what you have, right, a little bit more. So that's really interesting, and I've seen that even in myself, not that I'm becoming conservative at all, but just to be sure. Part of it is physical. But certainly in the past, I could sleep on any kind of floor. Like, I don't even need a bed, just a mod floor, one of those thin mats that you bought for us would be fine. And now I need a mattress, but a mattress that's the right level of softness. Otherwise, it presses on my stomach. Otherwise, if it's too soft, I get a bad back, etc. So the sum of that. And it does feel more cumbersome and more complex. Absolutely. You know, there's a certain amount of sort of free and easiness that slips. But at the same time, I think we can still work on our sense of contentment. Maybe our expectations in different areas come down. So like, okay, maybe I need a little bit more physical comfort, but maybe I'm much more realistic about practice, how practice looks, what mature practice looks like, how much retreat time to expect, how to expect others to behave. You know, nobody's enlightened. the kind of human behaviors that are possible, right? When I was younger, it was easy to walk away if I found a person's behavior not very good. But once you are like having responsibilities, then you have to reassess. So there's lots of ways in which I think we are continually able to develop deeper contentment. And I think that's right. It's very much related to expectation. The expectation is, in a sense, it's kind of predicated on discontent, right? It's like it comes from a sense of hoping things will be better or expecting things to be better, having very high standards, and it's future oriented. Yeah, it's not being where we are right now. So the more we can drop our expectations, I think the more we have a chance to start making peace with where we are now, what we have now, and who we're with now. So yeah. I really like that. And I also like the point you made about disparaging ourselves, because here it only says, you know, exalting oneself, extolling oneself and disparaging others. I guess that was more likely in ancient India. It's probably more likely generally as well, but I do think in certain cultures like our own, certain neoliberalist cultures, maybe neo-capitalism. I don't know the difference, actually. I'm probably saying it wrong. But anyway, you know what I mean. I think there's a lot of self-disparagement, and we're trained to be self-disparaging, to want more, to try to improve, to try to do more, to try and be more economically productive. And the same with discontent. It's encouraged in capitalism, obviously, because, you know, the people who are trying to sell us stuff want to make profits. They want to sell us more. So they don't want us to be content with Windows 10 or whatever. I'm getting pushed on Windows 11 now. It's like, I don't want Windows 11. I just don't care. I want to open my computer, see the screen, know where the stop button is, and that's enough for me. I want all these upgrades. So it's very difficult, isn't it, in society to go against the stream. But I do think as monastics, we have a bit more of a chance, even if we have nice places to live and nice mattresses, which are okay. I mean, they're not that nice. At least we share them with others, you know. At least we're kind of accountable to our donors. Everything's audited. You can't just start splurging, you know. Everything has to be for the purpose of the charity that it's aiming, the charitable aims that we have. So, yeah, lovely sutta, isn't it? I really like this. There was a lot more to pull out from it, but we can, I think, reflect on it afterwards. I'm thinking about the part about being skillful in this, diligent, clearly comprehending, and ever mindful. So it's a cultivation as usual, right? I mean, ever mindful is a high bar, but that this can be part of clear comprehension and mindfulness. So we often think mindfulness is just being aware of whatever's there, but part of mindfulness is actually developing beautiful qualities like contentment, being aware of when disparaging thoughts come up, when discontent comes up, and knowing the remedy, speaking in praise of contentment instead, not going in search in a wrong way, yeah, curbing those tendencies. So there's many, many solutions in here, as well as warnings, in a sense, the warnings of discontent. It's interesting. I mean, just to make one last comment, I really like this part about when you have vanquished discontent or continue to try your best to vanquish it, you can go anywhere. You're so much more confident, you can go anywhere. But when you are discontent, you actually have to keep moving, don't you? You can't stay in one place. You can't stay with what you have. You kind of, yeah, you're just always on the search. You're always on the run. And that's a really miserable place to be. Anyway, I don't like ending with the word misery, so let's end with the word contentment. And thank you for being contented to hear the Dhamma this evening. It's a wonderful thing to do, and to speak about it brings it even more deeply into our life. We actually have run out of time. Could we close the thing, and then we'll have one post sort of class question at the end. So anyone who wants to stay on for another 5 minutes is welcome. Anyone who needs to leave can leave. All right, so I'll invite Manori.
Thank you, Venerable, and thank you very much for the wonderful the discussion and lots of teachings, so valuable teachings. And so for us, again, today, I thought, you know, saying a few words about generosity and how develop the wholesome quality of generosity form the foundation of Dhamma practice. So the Buddha said that the wisest way to give is when one gives with a full heart full of joy for the purpose of beautifying the mind, for equipping the mind with the practice of serenity and insight. Anguttara 8.33. So generosity can also be a practice of checking in deeply with us. So on this note, I thought, since we are in Anukampa, there are several ways that we can cultivate this beautiful quality of giving. So, you know, we kind of highlight the financials, as Virba said, the people, sometimes it is you know, more kind of tangible to give things, but for Anukampa and many places, financial donation is a very important thing where it can be kind of, you know, sent to the proper needs. And so you can contribute, you can cultivate your good qualities, and you can help Anukampa. You can do a one-time donation for any amount. You can either, go to the website and Anukampa website. You can do a bank transfer, PayPal, or a sum up. If you are capable, you can do a regular donation through a standing order. Again, I want to highlight, every day, no amount is too small. Every amount, when it gets added up, is become a very useful amount to run the monastery, to support the teachings that Venerable does, and support the aims of the Anukampa. As you can see, there are Anagarikas, and there's so much of development. I'm sure, like in all of us, want to be part of it. And you can be tangible and provide meals to the donations, monastics as well. You can do either in person, you can do cooked meal delivery, you can do a supermarket delivery. If you want to do that kind of things, please get in touch with team@anukampaproject.org. And then you can organize. And if you check in the website, you can see the needed items as well. On that note, you might want to, if you haven't, subscribe to the newsletter so you'll get all what is happening with Anukampa, the latest teachings, Ajahn-Brahm events, if there are any free spaces yet. And thank you very much for being a part of today.
Thank you so much, Manoi. Really lovely to have the sutta highlighted there. So thank you for that. And lovely to hear your comments. And again, there is another question in the room. I think you probably didn't know that the time was out, so I don't want to disclude you. So this is our wonderful guest, Jiren from Malaysia. So if you need to go, please just head off, but it'll only be 5 minutes, I should think. And then maybe a little bit more Dhamma to end.
Yeah, I'd like to ask if the association between fear and ill will, how is it linked together?
Okay, so the association between fear and ill will. I think, how is it linked, basically? What is that association? And I think, for me, it becomes easier to understand the association when we don't translate dosa as ill will, but we translate it more generally as aversion. So it's like a kind of something that we don't like. So fear is a kind of aversive response. It's not a response of ill will necessarily towards something, although you could see it that way. Like, you feel afraid of a snake, it means you don't like the snake, right? But it's a kind of aversion response. It's a pulling away from. Whereas clinging, craving is a kind of moving towards and holding it, grasping it. So if you see those two movements of the mind, like kind of like movements, it's like one repels you from the object and another one will bring you towards the object and have you holding on to that object. It's like you pick it up, you don't want to put it down. Ill will is like you want to put it down. Aversion is like you want to put it down. So fear is a kind of form of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I guess they're related a bit, isn't it? It's like, because we generally don't like the feeling of fear, so then we can have aversion to the thing that's triggered the fear, or that's kind of we attribute to having brought up the fear, let's say. And it can also be to the fear itself. We can actually end up having aversion to the feeling of fear itself. What I've noticed with like strong anxiety is that it's very hard to be okay with it because it makes you feel anxious. So unless you can see, somehow have that little bit of perspective whereby you can see there's an opportunity to relate to it with a bit more warmth or a bit more openness, your way of relating to anxiety will be with anxiety. Your way of relating to fear will be with fear. So we get too close to it, we get kind of, don't like it.
But just be with it.
give a bit of space, actually. Mm-hmm. Give a little bit of surrounding so that you can like hold it there, but you can have some sort of warmth in the,
mm-hmm. kindness. The presence.
Some kindness, yeah. Yeah, some kindness to it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it can help to sort of imagine that fearful part of you as like a little child or something like that, and that you're the one watching, your bigger sister.
Mm-hmm.
You're like the elder sister to it, and it's like, oh, it's just this little child. If we stop identifying it and associating with it so much, mm-hmm. like this is me, this is happening to me, and we think, oh, look, it's happening to this part of me or to this child in me, then we can have like a sort of sense of wanting to embrace, wanting to comfort and soothe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Good. So may we all learn to embrace our fear and to cultivate our contentment little by little with everything we come across in our minds and also in our lives. So take care, everybody. I will unmute you now and we can wave goodbye. Thank you for your patience. Amazing. I wanted to stay. You want to wave goodbye?